Today they bring to us Ephraim Inbar, who is a professor of political studies at Bar-Ilan University and the director of the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, which seeks to contribute to the advancement of Middle East peace and security.
More security.
Okay. You'll explain that to us. Ephraim specializes in strategic issues, and he's authored five books, including most recently Israel's National Security Issues and Challenges Since the Yom Kippur War. Mr. Inbar served in the IDF as a paratrooper, was educated at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and at the University of Chicago here in the States, and has served as a visiting professor at Johns Hopkins in Georgetown and visiting scholar at Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and has also appeared at Harvard, MIT, Columbia, Oxford, and Yale. Those are all pretty good places. So Ephraim, welcome to the United States, to Philadelphia. Tell us what's going on.
Okay. I'll stand, right? Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm sure that here there will be a warmer atmosphere than some of the places you mentioned. Where I visit, where, you know, the academic world is not always friendly to us. I will speak about the Middle East upheavals and their impact, or the impact on Israeli national security. And I remember I was at Berkeley, of all places, when it started, and everybody there was very enthusiastic. And I was looking around, you know, I live in the same planet, or I was skeptic from the very beginning. And but obviously what happened is some kind of novelty. We see people who lost fear and are demonstrating in the streets. This is something unusual, you know, demonstrating in Philadelphia or in other places in the United States. It's not the same like the demonstrating in Middle East capitals. There you face shooting squads, so there is a big difference. But despite the fact that this courage is laudable, I think we should not fool ourselves to believe that the mobs or the people, the crowds in those capitals are the agents for democracy. We see already the initial results of what is the mood in our region. And I will stress actually three continuities in the Middle East, despite the fact that everybody is busy analyzing the novelty of the situation. The Arab upheavals has strengthened three strengths that have been in existence before. The first one is the weakening of the Arab state. The Arab state is in deep trouble, has been in deep trouble for some time, for the simple reason that the leaders of those countries have failed to modernize their countries. They are not modernizing leaders. The Arab world, unfortunately, has not produced modernizing leaders as, for example, the Turks and Ataturk, or people in Korea or Taiwan. And the Arab world is in deep social political crisis, and this is precisely why we have this upheaval, this great demonstration of frustration. And Arabs are indeed very frustrated, particularly if you take into consideration the past they once had. Which is 13th century, long time ago, but still they had once a great past, and suddenly they see quite clearly they are very far from leading the world, and they don't have the ability to be in the 20th century, not to speak about the 21st century. So what we see as a result of the turmoil, upheaval, a lot of political instability. We may see some of the countries, states, descend into civil war. They may become failed states. And even if there will continue to be states with a center of power, we see them further weaker and not real players on the international arena. There will not be states that will be able to divert resources to build missiles, to build large conventional forces. So we see weak states continuing to be weak and further weakened by the events. A second trend, again, something that is not new, concerns the regional balance of power. We see the continuous rise of non-Arab powers in the Middle East, particularly Turkey and Iran, at the expense of the weakened Arab states. Now the Arab world has lost its ability, basically, to balance those two states, particularly because Egypt, the strongest Arab state, is so much in crisis, and the two non-Arab states, Turkey and Iran, were better at modernizing, particularly Turkey. And Turkey in recent years has, and if you follow Daniel Pipe's readings, I'm not saying anything new, is actually joining the radical axis in the Middle East. Its Islamist colors become clearer and clearer, and it becomes more and more anti-American, and I would call it a Trojan horse in NATO. They are siding with the radicals. Again, not something new. In 2009, during the Israeli invasion of of Gaza, they sided with the radical states already, and the tensions with Israel are just a reflection of a deep change in Turkish foreign policy. The Iranians, of course, are anti-American, and they try to limit the influence of America and pro-American forces in the Middle East. And actually, both countries, Turkey and Egypt, benefit from the events. They actually encourage change in Egypt, which is their main Arab rival, not only because it weakens the Arab state, but also because it brings to the forefront political forces which are much closer ideologically to the ruling elites in Ankara and in Tehran. So we see those states benefiting. We may see, as in Syria, some kind of tension between them, and this is an arena of competition between them, but there is enough room for cooperation between those two states on the Kurdish issue, on issues of energy. Turkey is very much dependent upon energy from Iran and wants to play this ambitious role of an energy bridge to the West, and of course limiting American influence and limiting Israel. Israel is actually the only power left, in a real power left in the Middle East, to face the radical axis. You may count also Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia is not a power that is ready to fight seriously. They've done certain positive things in Bahrain, which I'll mention immediately. The third trend is the perceived growing American weakness in the region. And I'm saying perceived because I don't subscribe to the literature that America is in decline. I think America is strong, it will snap back, but for some time there was a perceived weakness of America, first of all because your adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan were not particularly successful. It was quite clear for some time that democracy in those states is not something which is really achievable, and the exit of American forces from those countries was something to be expected. Furthermore, during the last year, we've seen a very much confused American policy in which America is, from a native perspective, betraying its allies, betraying Mubarak, allowing the Europeans to start a war against Gaddafi. After all, Gaddafi cooperated with Americans, gave up his weapons of mass destruction in 2003, and sold oil. The lesson everybody learns in the Middle East is that you should keep your nuclear weapons. And I'm not sure this is a lesson Washington wants to teach the Middle Easterners. Also, the American criticism of Saudi Arabia when it intervened in Bahrain raised many eyebrows in the Middle East, be it of foes or friends, because after all, the Saudis were trying to do something good, finally, and they were trying to stabilize the pro-American regime. Some of you, I'm sure, know that the Fifth Fleet is based, its basis is in Bahrain. So what's going on in Washington? So I think the general perception in the Middle East, and not only of anti-American, but also of friends of America, is that the current administration doesn't get it, and is at loss. The Middle East, or at least the Middle East, the international affairs of the Middle East, are an issue too large for Washington, and don't know what they are doing. So what does all this mean for Israeli security? First of all, after almost a year of the upheaval, our main security, national security problem, remained unaddressed. It's Iran, of course. And actually, the events have deflected most attention from the main source of consequential change in the Middle East. If Iran will get the bomb, it's a serious development. And so far, nothing has brought about a more serious, a more muscular response on part of the West against the mullahs in Tehran. They simply gained 1 year more. And this is their strategy, basically. They are playing for time, and what happened played in their hands, not only on weakening their enemies in the Middle East, but also on the nuclear issue, on the nuclear project, which is a very important project to them, which is connected probably to the survival of the regime. And Israel is very much concerned. 1 year more passed, and this means that the issue, the hour of decision for Israel, whether to live with a nuclear bomb or Iranian nuclear bomb or to do something about it. When I say to do something about it, is I mean military action in order to destroy the key elements of the nuclear infrastructure. It comes closer. I don't know what the decision will be and when Israel will decide that there is no more time to spend. But obviously, 1 year has passed without a dent in the Iranian nuclear program. A second issue is the weaker Arab states, which is not bad for Israel. But actually, what we see is the chances for an all-out conventional war being reduced. Since they don't have the money, armies will be busy with domestic issues, domestic security, internal security, and they're not very good at that. In Egypt, we see after the dismantlement of some security agencies, the army is at loss. So it is a challenge for them, so they will not be able to bring themselves together and to build an alliance against Israel. Having said that, I think that we should be aware that if we see new elites in power, new elites may miscalculate. They don't have the experience that old dictators had. You know, I don't know what are your political tastes, if you like dictators or not, but, you know, there are certain advantages of having a guy in power for, you know, 20, 30 years. He knows the rules of the game. He has learned what he can do, what he cannot do. So all this is gone. And the new guy is in power, indeed, may make mistakes. Just to give you one example, which could be a very crucial mistake, is to introduce Egyptian forces into the Sinai and to violate the demilitarization agreement. This could be a casus belli for Israel. So, and this is a possibility. A proud Egyptian new leader wants to bring back sovereignty to Egyptian land, and he pushes a few tanks into the Sinai, and this becomes an international crisis. I think also we've seen it already, what we call diversionary wars. The leaders try to divert attention from domestic problems by starting tensions, terror campaign, or some kind of limited warfare against Israel. And Israel, in this type of situations in the past, has escalated because we are not willing to accept a war of attrition, and then we try to escalate in order to bring an end to the war. I think also that the weak states bring about greater chances for terror. We see those weak states losing control, losing the grip over their territory. The Israeli embassy was attacked in Egypt, in Cairo. At the same time, there were Egyptian mobs attacking the Ministry of Interior in Cairo, which is the symbol of the state. The Bedouins in Sinai attack Egyptian police stations, and we all know that the Sinai has become a highway for smuggling weapons. The Egyptians have no control over Gaza. And Gaza may become a Somalia. No monopoly of use of force. This is delineates failed states or failed areas. Somalia. And by the way, in the Middle East we have a few of those. So Israel probably will not be able to tolerate easily a Somalia on its border. We have Gaza, which is problematic. We have to deal with it, but if it's the whole border, you know, it's 200 kilometers and not just a few tens, it's a problem of a different magnitude. Also, those weak states have no control or lose control over the national arsenals. And we heard already about sensitive technologies, anti-tank missiles, anti-air missiles, coming out of Libya and getting to Hamas. We heard, I don't know how it's true, I doubt it, you know, that there is fissionable material, radiological material coming out of Libya. But those weak states are not able to guard well their national arsenals, and this means that the terrorists have greater freedom of action and greater access to weapons. A third problem is in the area of deterrence. Israeli deterrence is, of course, dependent upon Israeli might, but this is not the only factor that affects the Israeli deterrence. Another important factor is the perception that America will come to our need in case of a crisis, as it happened in 73, as it happened in 91. of course, now America is perceived in the Middle East as a not very reliable ally. The tensions between the Netanyahu government and this administration, which preceded already the Arab upheaval, of course, are not conducive to lead the Arabs to believe that America will stand next to Israel no matter what. Another issue which I want to raise is the peace process, which in my view has ended. The peace process as we know it is a reluctant acceptance on part of the Arabs that Israel is there to stay, and it's it may be useful in certain areas, and it can play the regional politics together with others. This started, of course, with the Egyptians. Afterwards, they had a peace treaty with Jordan. The peace with Egypt is under great strain. We hear, of course, a lot of voices demanding changes. At the same time, of course, the military says that it's committed to the peace peace treaty. The question is how strong the military is. So far, it entered into a coalition with the Islamists. It's a tough rider to tie, tiger to ride, and we don't know who will be the winner in this coalition. I think also that the military could be infiltrated by the Muslims. A researcher at my center, El Frisch, made a research and he came to the conclusion that the Egyptian army is the most religious army among the Arab armies. It doesn't mean that it's radical, but it means that it might be open to influence of radical Islamists. Jordan so far has weathered the crisis. But it is obviously responding to the growing influence of Islamists in Egypt and elsewhere, and it accepted just this week a delegation of Hamas. For years, Abdullah was successful in removing the Islamists from his country, and now he is trying to accommodate them, understanding there is a shift in power in the region. Obviously, the Palestinians, the deal or potential deal with them is, I never believed in it. Never, it's a strong word. For a while, I was taken by the elation of the Israeli people and Oslo and all this euphoria. I gained my sobriety soon, and those guys are not going to reach a historical compromise with the Zionist movement, let's face it, even the moderates. And I think what's happening in the Middle East is making this deal further away, because they also realize the growing power of the Islamists. They made a deal with Hamas, national unity, which not much comes out of it, but still, this is a reflection of the growing role of Islamists in Palestinian politics. So there is not going to be a deal with the Palestinians that they can live with or we can live with. I thought that maybe the Syrians can be involved. There is always. It was an oscillation for years between the Syrian track and the Palestinian track. But now I think everybody understands that we're very fortunate that we didn't make a deal with Syria before. Because if we'd have given up the Golan Heights, who is Syria today? So far, Assad doesn't run out of ammunition, and he is doing, well in order to stay in power. And this is high stakes politics in the Middle East. Not too many retired presidents. If he loses presidency, he loses his life. He fights for his life, for the life of his community, the Alawites. Situation may turn to a civil war. Of course, I don't know. Obviously, Syria is not a partner for peace with Israel now or any time in the near future. This will make things difficult for Israel because everybody wants peace. And, it's terrible not to have peace negotiations. And I think there will be a lot of pressure on Israel to try to demonstrate again and again that we are suckers for peace, and the world doesn't want to hear the bad news that there's not going to be a peace process. And there will be a dissonance between what the world wants to hear and what the Middle East can supply. I think also that we may see, and this is serious, threats to the freedom of navigation in the Eastern Mediterranean. Take a look at the map. No, Turkey is in the north. Egypt, Libya is in the south. If we see a Muslim axis between those powers, they may threaten the freedom of navigation in the Eastern Mediterranean. Cyprus is crucial for the West. I'm not sure the West understands it today. The Greeks fought again about Cyprus against the Persians many years ago. I don't know if you read Othello. It was the Venetians against the Ottomans. And Cyprus is still important as a Western bastion to keep those sea lanes open. For Israel, it's very problematic because a large part of our export-import goes via the Mediterranean. And this is a serious threat that we have to address. What does it mean? Finally, we part of the problems can be solved by money. Many problems can be solved by money. We simply need more money for defense. There is a lot of uncertainty in the Middle East. We've seen again the possibility of strategic surprises. We spend so much money on intelligence. We have a huge intelligence apparatus, and they didn't. We're not successful in giving a strategic warning. And by the way, I don't blame them. It's impossible to have this type of foresight for historic discontinuities. If we have to prepare for worst-case analysis scenarios, and this means we need larger force, and if we have to build a larger force, we have to make the decisions now. Because it takes time, particularly in the south. So we need, in my view, at least one division more in the south in order to defend ourselves. The south is empty. We have, a battalion of women, Caracal. But there is limited effectivity to this type of unit. We need, of course, a greater navy to defend the gas we found, which is very good news, but in the Middle East, legal rights is not enough. You need more to secure those rights. We need much more for R&D. We have to make sure that we are advanced enough, and this is our edge, basically, the quality of our weapons, of our small boxes which we had. And finally, we have to insist on defensive borders, because things can change quickly, and we need borders that will give us the best defensive advantage we can have in our area. The Middle East is, as you probably know, is a tough neighborhood, and it unfortunately may get nastier and more brutish. My personal view, I think that Israel is a strong country, and it has a strong economy, and we are able to meet those challenges if we make the right decisions. And hopefully, my government will make the right decisions in order not to meet in the future very bad scenarios with terrible consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Ephraim, you're willing to take questions.
Yeah.
I'll ask the first question. You noted that the Arab Spring has created a weak state situation, and that could be good for Israel in that they're distracted taking care of their own affairs. On the other hand, you also noted that the Islamists are showing strength, and that could suggest things along the lines of the caliphate or whatever. Give us your perspective on the likelihood of weakness versus the strength of the caliphate and timing of all of that in terms of time for Israel.
Well, a caliphate takes time to build, and you don't build an empire over a short time. The Turks, I think, are the best candidates for building an empire because they are most advanced in terms of on the modernization path. They have an army that is ready to fight. They are not Italians, they are ready to fight. they are proud people. I like Turks. Their economy is not so good from what I read recently. I don't think the Arabs are in the business of caliphate anytime soon. Iran, if it becomes a nuclear power, it's a different story. Then we'll see a lot of problems, and we'll see many. Just to give you one, Central Asia, which became free after the end of the Cold War, and tried to find its way and became pro-Western, actually. They are going to bandwagon to become closer to the Iranians or to get a nuclear umbrella from China or from Russia, which is closer because the Americans are seen as not relevant. Iran, a nuclear Iran, will gain control over the oil. It's not only the Persian Gulf, it's also the Caspian Basin. A nuclear Iran will also preempt the understanding that Saudi or Arabia or Egypt may go for a nuclear weapons, which will make their life more difficult. They will try to destabilize those countries, and they have done so successfully. Saudi Arabia, the eastern provinces, we read already about trouble, which they are mostly Shiites in the northern province, eastern province. So, and where all the oil is. In Egypt, I'm not surprised if we'll see Iranian agents. They were caught during Mubarak 2 years ago. So, they are doing their best in order to destabilize the Arabs and further weaken them. So we'll see this competition between Turkey and Iran. By the way, those are two old empires with great respect to each other, very cautiously behaving toward each other for years. But it's a long process. It's not... and of course, it depends on how... China doesn't go America way. China is on their side. The Russians are on their side.
Dr. Yaffe.
Obviously, not that I'm surprised, you made a presentation of very much of doom and gloom. You mentioned that the United States has no clue about how to help in the region. You mentioned that we haven't made a dent in the problem with nuclear Iran, which I think we have made a dent when we messed up with their computers and at least bought ourselves some time to stall their development program. But it seems your whole solution is just to keep a strong Israel militarily and independence. But my concern with all that solution of just is that just the growth of the population over there and having, time would seem to me...
Jewish babies?
No, but I have a problem with Arab babies in Israel, and I... have a problem that in the long run, if you're just waiting off the inevitable, that just by population and growth, time would be on the side of Palestinians and in that region collapsing and becoming more Islamic. I mean, I'm just trying. Well, I guess one of my point is I'm trying to figure out if we just take the tact of that you're suggesting. I think in time that could be defeatist. I don't know if there's another. I don't know how to propose another solution necessarily, but I don't know if what you're saying in the long run might not shoot ourselves in the foot as well.
Well, first of all, there is no real other choice but doing what I suggest. I indeed believe that the time factor is very important, and this is a dispute, in Israel between doves and hawks. And I believe that you understand that I am not on the dovey side yet. So I think that time is on our side. First of all, on the demography, time is on Israel's side.
Explain that to me, because I'd like to feel optimistic and leave here with some thread of optimism.
First of all, the
demography. Why do you say it?
First of all, you address the demography. The demography is a phony argument. First of all, the numbers of Jews is growing. Our fertility rate is growing, not only because of the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, but we see trends among the secularists and among the Russians, greater families. I'm not concerned.
Is this most recently? Because it was my understanding the only part where there was a growing trend in population was with the Orthodox. And the only city in this country, I think, that was increasing in Jewish population was Boston.
Boston.
Well, I'm not familiar with Boston, but in Israel, we have the highest fertility rate among the Western democracies in the world. The second is probably the United States, which shows that we are a healthy society. So, of course, the Europeans don't have babies, and
I'll make a comment.
They are doomed, but they have a real problem. The number of Arabs in Palestinian territories has been greatly exaggerated. I can, there are different counts, and we are, I think, we're doing well demographically. Apart from that, I think Israel is not interested in ruling over Nablus or Jenin. And we have built a fence. Do I care how many kids are being born in Cairo or in Amman? So we have a fence. This is more or less, it's not what I exactly want, but this is more or less the border of future Israel. And within those borders, Israeli demography is doing very well. And beyond that, it's not so relevant. Israeli economically, I think Israel is doing economically much better than our rivals. Ask any Palestinian, where do you want to be, on your side of the border or on Israel's side of the border? What do you think the answer will be? Economically, we are doing well. Socially, I think we are more united than ever as the Israeli society. It's here, it's portrayed, the New York Times, it's a divided society, society of tribes. I don't think it's true. When I was in the 70s, a student at Hebrew U, a political science student, the cleavages in Israeli society. One was socialism vis-a-vis capitalism. By now we are all good capitalists. It's over. This cleavage is not relevant. Another cleavage was the ethnic cleavage between Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jews. This is also no longer relevant. At my university, at any other university, no student cares whatsoever, who is Sephardi, who is Ashkenazi. A third of the marriages are what we call intermarriages. This is no longer an issue, with the exception of, Sephardis that didn't make it, or the ultra-Orthodox. But basically, this is no longer an issue. And even on the political issue, Greater Israel, the ideology of Greater Israel was once very powerful. It's no longer powerful. Everybody in Israel, again, I'm talking about 70%, a great consensus. 70% of the Israelis are in favor of partition. not the partition the Palestinians maybe are now talking about, but are ready for partition with the changes, revisions in the border. There is no debate. There, furthermore, the same number, over 70% of Israelis, understand very well that peace is not around the corner and the Palestinians are not a partner for peace and will have to continue to fight. And there is no reduction whatsoever in the number of kids that go into combat units. So Israel has displayed in recent years tremendous social resilience. We can continue to fight for years if this is what it takes. We don't enjoy it. You know, I was a paratrooper. My son is a paratrooper. I don't think I enjoy it, but if we have to do it, this is a price for having a country. Also in terms of isolation, I think, here in this country, people speak about Israel is isolated in the world. I am not sure at all. At the UN, the Palestinians didn't have such an easy time. Even in Europe, there are countries which are friendly to Israel. The most important countries, Germany, Italy, France, are led by pro-Israeli leaders. And we have wonderful relations with India. There are a lot of Indians in the world. I think that some of my colleagues in Israel are obsessed with the Palestinians. They do only Palestinian stuff. I do India, I do Korea. It's a large world out there. They are, the Chinese. They are not exactly our friend, but they think that we are the smartest people in the world. And of course, we run Washington, we run the world. I think there are many countries that have excellent relations with Israel. They are able to distinguish between the Palestinian issue and the other issues. So I don't think we are isolated. Time, as I see it, is on our side.
Professor Karsh?
Yeah, I just have a quick follow-up on the Boston. 63, I don't know the fertility rate, but 63 years ago you had about 5 million American Jews, and today you have 5 million American Jews plus minus. 63 years ago you had 600,000 Jews in Israel, and today you have 6 million. So not all of them is due to fertility rate. But the Israeli fertility rate, like Professor Inbar said, among Jews has been progressing quite rapidly over a longer period of time. And another thing, that the fertility rate among Israeli Arabs is going to be declining. So this is another. Is the fertility rate among Israeli Arabs or Palestinians, as they call themselves, is declining.
Why?
Because they are getting more affluent, better educated. They want to do other things than produce children and take care of them 24 hours a day. So, that's part of modernity. So I'm not saying this problem will go away. But I don't see the Arabs taking over Israel demographically, in our lifetime or our children's lifetime.
Thank you.
Ma'am?
How do you explain the naivete of the West? That we've persisted after the second month of what was going on to talk about the Arab Spring, or we attach the label moderate to the Islamist Party in Tunisia. How do you explain the West?
I'm not sure I have a good explanation. I don't know. I'm dealing primarily with Israelis in the Middle East, and the Western mind is something which... I'm serious. I'm not... I have a speculation, and I think that much of the tone in the West is set by liberal circles. Who at the universities, the elite newspapers... And liberals, and particularly Americans, even not liberals, are optimistic by nature. You think things will turn out well, obviously. You went all the way to Iraq to make them democratic. Come on, it's just... I had friends here telling them, go in, you know, kick the ass of those of this guy and go home. You know, go. You know, my conceptual framework was, you know, a Roman punitive expedition. You go in, put the bad guy's head on a spear and go home. This is in spear. This is what you should do, you know. The idea of turning those guys into Democrats was, you know, most Israelis, you know, even not on the right, you know, looking at the Americans, are they serious? By the way, the Mubarak, and they were fearful, you know. They want to bring democracy to our place. No, wait, why? It's my job at stake, you know. Yeah. So it was very strange, very strange. But you're America, you can afford big mistakes. You have two big moats on both sides of your country. So.
Comment and a quick question. My comment: Israel has three rather sophisticated submarines. They're buying two more from the Germans that are even more sophisticated than
Israel. Yeah. And maybe sure one this, more.
That would, and I'm sure this isn't for anti-shipping weaponry. But my question to you is, could you speculate, if Syria should fall, what effect that may or may not have on Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah? And how much pressure should the West, my country, and Israel do if that would be a positive event?
I wish there would be only positive effects. Obviously, the fall of the Assad regime will weaken the Shiite arc. But Hezbollah is strong enough. It's an organization with domestic roots, strong domestic roots. Supplying it with weapons is not necessarily dependent upon Syria. And nowadays, the Suez Canal has been opened up to Iranian vessels, partly result of growing Islamic influence. So Hamas will stay in the most important actor in Lebanon. Hamas, I'm not sure how much it will be influenced because it is in the border of Egypt. Egypt has now opened the gates of Gaza, is considering a Hamas diplomatic delegation in Cairo, so the times are better for Hamas. What will happen in Syria? We may see greater Turkish influence. The Turks are behind the opposition, partly Islamic. What do I want? Assad and Syrian influence or Turkish influence? It's a dilemma. You know, I think the Assad fall will give us some benefit immediately, but in the long run, may create other problems.
Bob Gazzardi.
The United States funds UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and the United States also gives money to the Palestinian Authority, millions and billions. My understanding is that the Israelis want that to continue. My understanding also is that Israel controls the electric grid into Gaza, shipment of food, etc. So I was joking to myself, supposing Hamas is successful and pushes Israel into the Mediterranean. What happens next? You control their whole infrastructure. If you don't run their electric, who will? What happens?
So you're concerned about Gaza?
I'm concerned about why. Here's what I want. I want to step back and not give millions and billions to terrorists. And I think that is bad American policy. Every time I talk to that, and I know that Daniel Pipes is working on it, you are slogging against both the Israelis and people in America. But the Israelis are the ones that concern me. I mean, is there a chance that some of the, if I may, the right-wingers would say, you know, this is a good idea, get on board with...
Well, first of all, some right-wingers say it, and... I share your frustration.
Ah.
I think that what they are doing in Gaza vis-à-vis the Palestinians is plain stupid.
Ah, wonderful.
I mentioned, you know, one of my professors, sometimes professors can be very boring, but once in a while they say something. And one of them said, Professor Yecheskel Dror deserves a quote. Said that the best explanation for government output is stupidity.
Stupidity.
And so I think that Israel should stop giving food. We should not give water. We should not give electricity to Hamas. They are shooting at us. It's immoral, I think, to do it.
Correct.
About the Palestinians, I think that the Israeli government position to be a shtadlan, to lobby for the Palestinians to get $500 million, despite the fact that they are not doing what we are asking them and not doing what the Americans are asking them, is again, it's I believe in reciprocity. Somebody wants my money, he has to do certain things for me.
Right.
And the Palestinians seem to do whatever they want, and they still get American money. This is, by definition, a bad policy, because they have no incentive to do what the Americans want them to do. I think there is a misconception, particularly in the Israeli defense establishment, and this policy is a result of the bad influence Barak has over Netanyahu.
Thank you very much.
Sir?
Hey, you mentioned that Israel needs a bigger, stronger navy. Has there been any studies done on what they exactly need? What kind of ships, what kind of assets?
Well, I think, of course, the submarines is one area. We need larger ships. Our ships are old. We have to renew them, even if we don't build larger ships, at least to renovate our navy. Apart from that, for example, as a minister of finance once, when he was head of the defense committee in the Knesset, he spoke rightly about trying to put some of our strategic assets in the sea. The runways can be bombed. A ship, is more difficult to find. There is, because Israel is so small, we can expand our strategic depths into the sea. This should be done. To put it simply, Israel is a small country with problems of a superpower.
Sorry.
You were mentioning the about making the grid, the electric grid. I was in Israel, I think it was 07 or 08, when the Palestinians fired the Hamas fired a missile at the coal bunker in Ashkelon. We scratch our heads trying to figure out. I mean, this is where the electricity goes from Ashkelon to northern Gaza. My question is, you didn't mention air. You mentioned the threat on the north, south, east, and west, and the west being the sea. I believe in a couple of years, there's going to be an air problem because the missiles technology is improving so rapidly. Well, I don't know if I should use the word improving, but it's being developed so rapidly that within a few years, I would say, at most five, so probably maybe less, we'll start seeing real threats to the planes going to and from Israel. And it may be LL or maybe other carriers. It is my feeling that something is wrong with the dynamics, it's a simplistic statement, in the Middle East, because with the proper information and proper education, the minds of the people in the Middle East can be changed within one generation. I read a little bit about the schools where they teach the Arab world schools, such hatred for the Jews and for Israel. I think where Netanyahu and previous governments have been stuck in the same mode, negotiation mode. Something, we've got to break out of this mode. What do you think? So find a whole new way of integrating Israel into the greater Middle East area of the world and showing the value of Israel to these people. I said a lot. But.
Listen, they don't want us to be valuable to them. Haiti such a... Anybody that cooperates with Israel is immediately branded as a traitor. Even if we try to help somebody, we have to do it, under the table. So, it looks to Westerners, a combination between, Jews and, the Arabs would be wonderful economically. It doesn't work.
But historically, it did work.
When?
Before I was born, in the 1600s, 1700s.
Yeah, but then we didn't have a state. They are not ready to tolerate a Jewish state.
They didn't tolerate.
That's the problem. As second-class citizens, sure, yes, they'll take advantage of our skins. Yeah, but no. About the air issue, I think that we should invest in R&D to deal with those issues. We are actually at the edge. We are the best in terms of anti-air missile at all levels. At all levels. And we are building now a four-tier defense. Israeli airplanes are equipped with special equipment that can deal with incoming missiles. So we have a big air force. I'm not sure, by the way, that the future, we need manned airplanes. We are moving to a different era. Robotics, we have robots in the Navy, we have robots on the border, everywhere. So a pilot has physical limitations. We have the best pilots, but still they're humans.
Ms. Rentz?
Yes, hi. With the exiting of American troops in Iraq and the drawdown probably of troops in Afghanistan, what do you think the effect of this is going to be, the perception in the Middle Eastern world of the United States, and what effect will it have on the stability or even instability of what's going on in the Middle East right now?
I'm very happy you asked this question because I want to give you an answer probably you didn't think about, but the only way to get out of the Middle East, and you'll get away, and you are doing right in my view of getting away from Afghanistan and Iraq, is with the big bang in Iran. If you leave those countries and at the same time you punish the Iranians and destroy their nuclear infrastructure, then everybody's afraid of you. Fear is the best political currency in the Middle East, and that's what you should do. And then it's not out of weakness. Okay, you tried, it didn't work. Those guys were not willing to take benefit of the American goodwill. Fine. But you deal with the main strategic issue, which is Iran.
And if the other Western countries don't jump on board, or still do have economic ties to Iran?
America needs other countries to do it. You have a huge air force. You have so many carriers there. You can do it. No problem for America to finish. You are a superpower. Behave like a superpower.
But I was just reading that with the decrease in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're thinking of moving troops into Kuwait and those other areas. Now, why do you suppose we'd want to do that?
Because there is pressure. You have to do something. There'll be weakness. So, the cheapest way is to move them from Iraq to Kuwait.
But the point is that if we keep the troops in the Middle East, then it's easier if we do decide to go after Iraq. I don't think the United States Iran. I don't think the United States is just categorically going to pick up and bomb Iran. I really don't. So you know, but the question is, then why move our troops into Kuwait?
What's your answer?
I don't know. I don't know.
Moshe?
Yeah, Professor Inbar, you raised a couple interesting topics. One is the unexpected historical discontinuity, as you termed it, for which you did not fault the Israeli intelligence establishment for having sensed it coming. And the other was the stupidity of policymakers, that they're doing stupid things. This theme of the stupidity you see in the analyses, the commentary of people like Barry Rubin, whom analyses I respect and enjoy, and also Professor Dr. Pipes. But couldn't one also reasonably infer from the behavior of the Obama administration, for example, that its behavior does not stem from stupidity, but is a considered, well-thought-out policy that stems from certain circles within, let's say, the American security establishment? If you look back at American policy, back to 1947, 48, when they had to decide on whether to support the Zionist entity in Palestine, the nascent American post-war American intelligence community came out with an NIE, I believe at that time it was already called an NIE, a National Intelligence Estimate, which recommended against supporting the Zionists, as did, of course, most of the British Foreign Office, most of the State Department, most of the British High Command. So this is an approach that is sort of continuous, one might speculate, within the those circles in the West. So perhaps we're not talking about stupidity, but about a considered policy. We read in the press that the Obama administration is consciously trying to cultivate the Muslim Brotherhood, which people say this is stupid. Barry Rubin writes, how can they do this? Well, it depends what your assumptions are, and the assumptions aren't necessarily stupid. There's a method to the madness, let's say. So I'd like to ask, as a political analyst, as a historian, whether there are other explanations other than gross stupidity of policymakers to explain such serious decisions as to, let's say, support the Muslim Brotherhood, as indeed the Obama administration most clearly has done in the Middle East, in Libya, in Egypt, in Turkey.
Well, first of all, in principle, the mere fact that a certain policy is considered strategic and is well thought doesn't mean that it's not stupid. So they have a stupid strategy, you know. I think that there is a certain group of people in America that are CIA and others are talking about, you know, moderate Islam, and they have this mantra of moderate Islam, which doesn't work. You know, Erdogan is not moderate Islam, despite what some people say in Washington. And the Obama administration tried to open a dialogue with the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. And they, do you know what happened? The Muslim Brothers in Egypt say, no, thank you, we are embarrassed, we don't want to deal with Americans. It's pastnished, you know, it doesn't. Man, we are reasonable guys, we don't deal with American, you know, Satan. And so, you know, they don't want to be part of your strategy. I think it's misguided. I think the real prism is power politics, and this is a prism of the elites in the Middle East. They are their glasses are power politics, and you should play power politics and not other things. And but I think there is a true perception in the Middle East that it's not a strategy. It's going here, going there, and a weak president. And, you know, you had guys that commanded respect in the Middle East. You know, Baker. You remember Baker? Mm-hmm. Everybody was afraid of Baker. He told everybody, come to Madrid. They came. You know, now, can he, poor Obama, he tells Abu Mazen, come to Washington. He said, no, I don't want to come. You know, and he gets $500 million from Obama.
Someone might argue it's a different world now than when Baker was had the control and the power. It's a little bit different world.
To some extent, it's different. The effect of the fall of the Soviet Union has evaporated. But still, America is America. And it depends much on the Americans, how they behave. And the rest of the world is responding.
So you just feel the United States should just go all guns blazing and do it because we're America and we're the superpower, and there's no other superpower threat to America to just go ahead and do that?
No, I think that you should have a very, very judicious use of force. I think spending resources in Iraq was wrong. Spending Afghanistan, to try to change Afghanistan.
But it wasn't Obama who did that.
Yeah, but it was Obama.
I mean, but it's America. I'm not blaming only Obama. I'm speaking about.
Like you were.
No, I spoke about a perceived weakness of America that started even before the Arab upheaval. Those were policies which, the test is in the pudding. They were not successful. By now, we all know Iraq is not pro-Western, is not democratic. Afghanistan, of course not. Those were failures.
Agreed.
Okay, so this policy failed. And not because of lack of American determination.
Agreed.
So, you should behave in a smart way. I'm not, even for Israel, I don't advocate use of force. We have to be very careful. Use of force has to be moderate. I'm of an old intellectual tradition, of Machiavelli, Kissinger.
Cautious. Do you think that the United States and Israel should cautiously apply more military force or more military movement together against Iran?
Iran, yes. And again, I don't think that we can change Iran. But we can change their ability to build a bomb. I'm very suspicious of attempts at political engineering, of changing the environment. You cannot change the natives. We tried in Lebanon, we tried that. It doesn't work. We cannot change people. They do business as they've done for years. But in Israel's view, America should take care of factors that can harm it. That's it. Israel, the same. We should I advocate a very cautious and modest foreign policy to deal only with threats. I don't believe in a new brave Middle East. It's beyond us.
Do you